The most important is not how you lose weight in the dieting periods, but the most important is maintaining weight during the energy balance phase.
Welcome to the Metagenics Clinical Podcast, where natural healthcare practitioners can hear innovative, cutting-edge information from leading experts from around the world.
Welcome to Metagenics Clinical Podcast. I'm Nathan Rose, and with me today is obesity researcher, Professor Amanda Salas. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks, Nathan. Happy to be here.
Fantastic. So we're going to dive in to obesity again. I'm going to follow on from the podcast I did recently with Stefan Guionet, who we spoke about the set point of obesity, how people, their brain essentially chooses a body weight it prefers, which may not be in line with our conscious ideals of where our body weight should be. So I want to dive into some of the neurobiology behind that and then look at some of the strategies you've been exploring in your research, and also look at some of the popular dieting trends that are being used today, and maybe how they do or don't help with this neurobiology of obesity. So maybe before we dive in, perhaps just a little bit of a bit on your background, how you have become involved in obesity. It's something personally you've been involved with for a long period of time, is that correct?
That's right. So it all started as a adolescent when I was with a BMI, body mass index, in the obese range myself, always dieting, always trying something, you know, that could help me. And I was always fighting up against my own body systems, you know, the hunger that kicks in when you start losing weight. I mean, every diet is fine in the beginning, but after you've been on the diet for a while, your hunger kicks in, you start to feel sluggish, it's hard to continue with the exercise. And I thought, well, if we could just overcome that physical barrier, obviously there's more than physical barriers in obesity, there's the whole environment which is obesogenic, and there's emotional issues. But for me, I thought if we could find out what that physical barrier from inside the body is, then it would be a way to help bust through and lose weight effectively. So that's hence my passion for obesity research and finding better ways to break down that that wall, that barrier that we all have within us that prevents us from losing weight easily.
Okay, interesting. Well, let's dive into those barriers. So there's this concept of adaptive thermogenesis, where the body adjusts basically to the energy restriction the person's doing when they're on a diet. So first, perhaps let's dive into how this is controlled in the brain, in the hypothalamus, how it receives these sort of signals and how it makes decisions based on these signals.
Yeah. So first of all, to clarify, this concept of adaptive thermogenesis, that's only part of the barrier that our body elicits against weight loss. So adaptive thermogenesis is where our metabolic rate or energy expenditure is reduced when we eat less or exercise more. So that's part of the problem. But the major part of the problem is that with weight loss, hunger or the drive to eat increases. And that seems to be these two together, increased hunger and reduced energy expenditure, contribute to that difficulty with losing weight. And it seems from research that increased hunger is the main problem, main culprit. But in any case, the parts that hunger and that reduction in metabolic rate, they seem to be controlled by the same part of the brain, with some common mechanisms, at least in some elements of the mechanism. So when a person is losing weight, they're dieting, or they're exercising more, or both, what happens is once there's a certain amount of fat loss, the hypothalamus will register, okay, well, we've got less fat now than the set point, and then it's like the hypothalamus kicks in with this neurochemical changes that collectively lead to reduced energy expenditure as well as increased hunger. And this is happening in the hypothalamus, and it seems to be instigated in the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus.
Interesting. And this is where, like, the hypothalamus will essentially attenuate, say, the thyroid function, and obviously increase the hunger. But I think for some clinicians, we've often hunted for, like, this hypothyroidism driving obesity, but would it more so be the fact that the hypothyroidism is a consequence of the energy restriction? And
yeah, so hypothyroidism with obesity treatment or subclinical hypothyroidism is something that happens during weight loss efforts in people with overweight or obesity. So thyroid function will be reduced in some capacity. You don't always see it very clearly on, for example, clinical measures of thyroid function, but you might see it on increased levels of reverse T3 or maybe reduced levels of T3 or reduced levels of T4, or maybe you see it in a cellular level in the tissues,
right.
Yep. You see less conversion to the active thyroid hormones in the tissues themselves, or less TSH. So you do sometimes see reductions in thyroid function with dieting, but this is only part of it. There's also that hypothalamus, so the hypothalamus which instigates those changes in thyroid function, it's also inducing changes in the output of sympathetic nerves, and that those sympathetic nerves activate energy expenditure, for example, production of energy for heat. And during weight loss, that sympathetic output is decreased transiently and energy expenditure is reduced. Then there's also the hypothalamus, which is controlling appetite. And nobody really knows how chemical changes in the hypothalamus lead to an altered drive to eat. You know, the connection is not really clear and not really known, but through neurochemical changes, neuropeptide changes, there is this increased drive to eat. So thyroid function reduction is part of it,
mm-hmm.
but there's a whole swag of responses that make it really hard for people to lose weight.
Yeah, right. Just in the hypothalamus then, and yeah, as you said, science still is not completely clear on some of these mediators, but there are a couple reasonably well-known mediators. Would you say there's a couple of neurons and that the peptides they secrete are synonymous with appetite and satiety? Is that correct? Can you dive into those?
There's some what I call the ringleaders
in
the adaptive response to energy restriction. I call it, I tend to call it the famine reaction. It's easier to say than adaptive response to energy restriction. And the ringleaders are a couple of orexigenic peptides or peptides that promote food intake and also reduce energy expenditure. And major culprits there are neuropeptide Y and a GUTI-related peptide. There are others, but these seem to be ringleaders in that if you you block both of these, then you can get some leeway into reducing things. But, you know, like with all ringleaders, they've always got a whole bunch of workers working with them and supporting them. So even if you knock out the ringleaders, for example, neuropeptide Y or a GUTI related peptide, and I spent like a decade looking at, wow, can we knock out this ring with genetic modification in mice? And what would happen invariably was we'd knock one out or we'd knock the receptor for one out. Once we even knocked out four receptors in a single mouse for the receptors for one of these ringleaders, neuropeptide Y, and we thought, that's it, we've got it. You know, we've got the ringleader, we've got all the, you know, the mules that are doing the work for the ringleader. We thought we're going to definitely get an animal now that's lean, that doesn't respond to dieting with an adaptive response or a famine reaction. But what happened, and this is the thing that triggered me into doing human research as opposed to mouse research, was that we knocked out all these four genes in a single mouse and the mouse was more obese than a control mouse.
Wow.
Whereas we expected that mouse was going to be lean. And it just shows that when you knock out something in that orexigenic pathway, any of the molecules that play a role in adaptive responses to energy restriction, you knock out one of the players or many of the players, and something else just comes in and takes its place, and it comes in with a vengeance and does an even stronger job. So, those ringleaders are very, very powerful.
You must have been stumped after that. Physiology never ceases to amaze me about the redundancy, and we try and make things black and white, and then there's all these grey and context that shows up.
Exactly. It's a bit like blood pressure regulation, you know, with blood pressure is regulated in the hypothalamus, and to have any impact on it, you need several drug types to, you know, have an impact. And with obesity, anything that's pharmacological will need to target a lot of different pathways.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's why I moved to looking at what we can do with what we've got now available to us in terms of nutritional therapy, lifestyle therapy. What can we do now with the tools that are available now? Because I think the drugs for obesity treatment are, you know, a good decade away.
Still a long way off. Okay. Well, let's move now to human research. And just before we move on to how to potentially solve it, what are some of the things that have been noted in humans whilst undergoing caloric restriction? Some of the, I suppose, negative side effects due to this adaptive thermogenesis, say, on muscle mass or bone and metabolism.
Yeah, so we do know that in humans, you can't really look into the brain and see what's happening to their levels of neuropeptide Y or Agouti-related peptide during a diet or in a diet and exercise regime. But we've got a fair idea that what might be happening in their brains is similar to what's happening in mouse brains or rat brains, because we see neuroendocrine responses that in humans during dieting that are similar to what you see in mice and rats and other animals when you infuse those peptides into the brain. So in humans that are dieting, as I mentioned, you'll see reduced thyroid function. You'll also see increased activation of the hypothalamo-pituitary-adrenal axis. So you'll see increased levels of cortisol. You don't see it all the time, depends on the time of day and the phase of the diet that you measure. In some cases, you'll see an increased cortisol, which is like a stress response. You'll see also reduced IGF-1 concentrations in some paradigms. And in some paradigms, you'll also see reduced active concentrations of sex hormones like testosterone or estradiol. And so these are all some of the hormonal changes that happen with dieting. You also see increases in concentrations of hormones that promote hunger, like ghrelin, and reductions in concentrations of hormones that induce satiety, such as peptide YY. So these are hormonal changes that promote the drive to eat. And these neuroendocrine changes with weight loss, they always worried me, because I saw them in rats and mice, and I was looking at the mechanisms for those hormonal changes in rats and mice. And, you know, if you take those same hormonal changes that you see in people during weight loss programs and you impose those changes, or they're experimentally or medically imposed on people, without overweight or obesity, what you see is adverse outcomes for body composition. For example, with less IGF, less sex hormones, more cortisol, you'll tend to see loss of lean body mass, loss of muscle tissue, loss of muscle strength. You'll also tend to see loss of bone, as well as a tendency to store fat in the midriff region. So that was why I was very interested to understand, well, what's happening during dieting to people's body composition? Because obviously, well, we need to treat obesity, but if the treatment for obesity is chipping away at people's musculoskeletal integrity, then we need to be aware of that and really take measures to work against it. For example, absolutely insist somehow that weight loss is not performed without strength training, for example. So there have been systematic reviews and meta-analyses, some of which my team and I have conducted, And we have seen that with weight loss, there is some loss of muscle strength and there is some loss of bone mineral density. But and this would be consistent with some of those neuroendocrine changes that are seen with weight loss. But what we don't know is, you know, these aren't really good changes, loss of bone density and loss of muscle strength, but how does that downside of weight loss weigh up against the really clear good sides of weight loss, which is reduced diabetes medication, reduced risk factors for cardiovascular disease, etc. So it's probably something more to be aware of and something probably that we need to be really strong about advocating for exercise during weight loss programs, especially weight-bearing and strength training.
Yeah, interesting. I think there's always a focus on the aerobic component because it can enhance weight loss, and I believe it can also better improve the hormonal milieu, I suppose, of diet-induced obesity, but perhaps we don't pay enough attention to maintaining the muscle mass and strength. So that really highlights that people who are once obese that have lost weight do not have the same physiology, I suppose, of people who have never been overweight. Would that be true?
Yes, that's correct. If you we always say that obesity is only ever managed. It's never cured. And I know, speaking personally, it's been a long time since I lost or ate, but I still need to manage that excess weight because it can come back any time. I feel it's just waiting to come back. But what we don't know about obesity, and one of the big questions in the field, and there is a lot of debate about this, is, I mean, it's agreed in the field that when a person goes on a weight loss diet or a diet plus exercise program, that there will be adaptive responses and a whole range of adaptive responses. They're all working to prevent fat loss, to prevent weight loss. We know that that happens, but the big controversy in the field is how long do those changes last for? So in some research, these changes last for 1, 3, even 6 years after the diet has finished. Even though people have regained some of the weight they lost, they still show signs of these adaptive responses to energy restriction. And in other sets of studies, independent studies, probably an equal number of studies, you see that these adaptive responses to energy restriction dissipate after 10 days, 14 days, okay, 3 months or a year after weight loss. So it's not really clear if once you've lost weight and once your body has responded with those adaptive responses to energy restriction, it's not really clear how long they last for. And it's likely that they may last forever in some people, and in other people they may be able to dissipate or subside with time.
Wow.
And
that can be even after like a 10 or 12 week diet, say a year later, that they've only dieted for 3 months, yet 9 months later that's still elevated levels of hunger, etc.
Exactly. Wow. That's right. Yeah, 9 months later, even 6 years later in one study.
Wow. So it sounds a bit pessimistic, but now let's turn our attention to the research you've been doing to perhaps mitigate or at least offset some of this with your recent study, the Matador study. Can you explain some of the details there on this one?
Yeah. So the Matador study is a study where it's a randomized controlled trial where this is a study done that I did in collaboration with Professor Neula Byrne and others, and the study was led by Neula Byrne. And in this study, what we did is we randomized people to either continuous dieting, so just your regular type of 30% reduction in kilojoule intake relative to kilojoule requirements. So it's a slow and steady kind of diet continuously for 16 weeks. And in the other group, we randomized them to that same 16 weeks of energy restriction, but after every 2 weeks of energy restriction, we gave them a 2-week break from the diet, in that instead of providing them with food that was 30% restricted relative to their energy requirements, we provided them with food that delivered 100% of their estimated energy requirements. So it was a bit like a break from the diet, although they were still eating food that we provided. And the rationale for having these 2-week breaks from energy restriction in the intermittent group was that we had seen research that showed that in some studies, some of the adaptive responses to energy restriction can be attenuated or completely abolished by a period of 10 to 14 days in energy balance. So, you know, pharmaceuticals and genetic research, the kind of research that I was doing, you know, we're looking for this drug that's going to reduce that adaptive response to energy restriction. And it's really elusive. As I mentioned, you know, that hypothalamus is a tangle of redundancy, all trying to protect us against weight loss. But here we have the possibility that providing people or allowing people to eat more food for a period of 2 weeks, that may be able to, you know, take off or remove that adaptive response that's making it hard for them to lose weight. So that was the rationale for giving that 2-week period on energy balance. It's like a weight loss drug in a way, yeah. But provided by food. And we did find significantly greater weight loss and significantly greater fat loss, with no difference in lean tissue loss in the people on the intermittently energy restricted diet compared to people on the continuous diet. And the increase in weight loss, it was almost an incremental 5% more. So the weight loss was around 14% of body weight in the people on the intermittent diet compared to around 9.5% on the continuous diet. So this is the kind of difference in weight loss that if you could get a weight loss drug that produces that much more weight loss than a placebo drug, and as long as it doesn't have side effects, then you'd be able to market that and sell that for a lot of money. But here we have something that is providing that improved weight loss and fat loss. And it's something that's potentially accessible to everyone.
Well,
it's
pretty amazing results. It's quite a big difference. So with the diet break period, can you just clarify? I think we've shown it to some people and it can be misinterpreted as like overeating and going overboard in a sense. But it's energy balance, as I understand, and the goal is not necessarily to lose weight that period, but to essentially remain weight stable. You shouldn't see like an increase in weight and then that 2-week off period. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So we've just written a large review on this, which we've had some good news from the journal today about publication. And what happens is people alternate between periods of very severe energy restriction to periods of moderate energy restriction, back to severe energy restriction and then moderate energy restriction. But throughout the whole intervention, they're in some kind of energy restriction, just varying levels.
Right.
And from looking at the data and the outcomes from those trials and looking at the adaptive responses to energy restriction that were measured in those trials, we think that if people remain in energy restriction during the diet, then they don't get that proper alleviation or relief from those physiological changes that are causing those adaptive responses. So it seems very important that people get out of energy restriction when they're having a diet break. So it's really important to get out of energy restriction. It's important to eat enough so that your body is not perceiving ongoing energy restriction. But on the other hand, in the trials where people got out of energy restriction, but they seemed to overeat, as indicated by weight gain during the diet breaks, then the weight gain during the diet breaks just offset the weight loss during the energy restriction, and there wasn't any benefit over and above continuous energy restriction in terms of weight loss. So, yes, it's a diet break. We tend to call it an energy balance phase because energy balance is what we're going for. We don't want energy restriction and we don't want energy excess.
Right.
And, yeah, the next step in research is to find out how to achieve that in people free living in the society. But certainly daily weighing is probably
one. Yeah, sure, because you provide all the food on both phases of the diet. So, and just to clarify, they lost more weight on the diet using the pulsing or the diet, intermittent dieting. It wasn't just because they did the diet for longer, but the actual, while they're dieting, they tend to lose more weight in that period. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So when we looked at how much their weight was changing on the periods off, or on the periods of energy balance, the average weight change was zero kilos plus or minus 0.3 kilos. So there was no weight change during those periods off the diet on average. So the greater weight loss was not because they were continually losing weight over the whole longer time. It was because they were losing more weight when they were on the diet. Yes.
Okay, great. Maybe for people that want to start and trial this themselves, I imagine you'd need to first establish your weight stable caloric intake, maybe 2 or 3 weeks of just recording, find your average, then you'd work out a 30% reduction from there, and then you'd oscillate between the two.
Yeah, I think the most important is not how you lose weight in the dieting periods, but the most important is maintaining weight during the energy balance phase. So, yeah, determining how much you need to eat to maintain your weight is a really good start. So you could do this, yeah, as you say, with a food diary. It doesn't have to be with determining kilojoule intake. I mean, myself personally, I just cannot, my body can't understand kilojoules because, yeah, it's just so abstract. When it comes to eating, it's like, yeah, it does. But so, you know, you can either count kilojoules or you can either, you know, use a food diary and look at, okay, well, this is how much I usually have for breakfast, lunch and dinner or whatever, snacks, and get a really good feel for how much you need to eat to maintain weight, and then just apply that during the energy balance phases.
Right.
And eat less the energy restriction phase, and anything less than what you need to eat for weight maintenance. If you do it over a consistent period of time, like 2 weeks, it will result in weight loss.
Okay, great. And finally, just back to your results, one thing we didn't touch upon was, well, two things you mentioned, like the hunger, the adaptive responses, the metabolic rate decreases and the hunger increases. Did you measure either of those, and what was the results from the trial?
Yes, so we measured both of those and the hunger hormones as well. So we're writing that up for publication now. With the energy expenditure, we measured that, and it seemed that the energy expenditure was reduced to a lesser extent in the people on the intermittent energy restriction compared to people on the continuous energy restriction, in terms of because everyone, when they lose weight, they're going to have a reduction in energy expenditure, and just because their body is smaller, and the people on the continuous diet, their energy expenditure was reduced even more than you would expect based on that smaller body size, whereas the people on the intermittent diet, their energy expenditure was only reduced to the extent that you'd expect it to be reduced based on a smaller body size. So it seems there was some metabolic advantage of the intermittent energy restriction in terms of less of a drop in energy expenditure.
And sorry, the hunger?
And the hunger, we'll watch this.
Okay, yeah, yep.
Get that cool. out there in the once we've done all the analysis and analysed it really carefully.
Yeah, all right. Just one last thing on this concept of refeeding, if you want to call it that. I heard this a while ago that when they first, a couple of researchers proposed there's two methods you can do this refeeding, this period like you did. And the other one, which is often employed like in bodybuilding and fitness communities, this concept of reverse dieting. So obviously these athletes and people go, they diet down to quite a low body fat and they can apparently after a contest or whatever, within a week or so, rebound dramatically back to when before they even dieted. Some are employing this strategy of slowly increasing the calories incrementally each week, but not getting it straight back up to the energy balance. Is there any rationale or evidence for that more slow and progressive approach?
Yeah, so the reverse dieting, it makes sense because straight after a period of energy restriction, so for example, in that athlete or anyone, athlete or non-athlete, at the end of a period of weeks of dieting, energy restriction will be reduced. And if you go straight back on to the amount of food that you were eating before, even if you reduce it a little bit because you've got a smaller body size and you do need less energy, if you go straight back to that level of food intake, then you'll just gain weight. And also the other thing is once you've been dieting for a period, your body is stripped of all its excess glucose carbohydrate stores, so all the glycogen in your liver and muscles has been stripped away. And when you start eating again, you'll quickly gain back that glycogen and you'll gain weight, but it's not fat, it's just glycogen and water weight.
Right.
So by taking it slowly, you keep losing a little bit of fat while your body is gaining back that muscle, and so therefore you don't see that shocking increase on the scales that can derail people and put them. But also once you finish dieting, your metabolism, according to some of the research, which shows that the drop in metabolic rate is transient and can be reversed in 10 or 14 days or 3 months or something, with time, metabolic rate should come back up to normal. And I've seen it happening in people in the lab that have dieted, and I've seen with my own eyes, the measurements of metabolic rate, those people's metabolic rate before the diet, during the diet and after the diet, and I see it goes down and metabolic rate comes back up again some weeks or months after the diet. So it makes sense to reverse diet and refeed slowly. Don't go straight into eating as much as you would if you'd never dieted straight away.
All right, so there's two strategies there. Brilliant. Okay, so now I just want to transition to another intermittent. So we've covered off intermittent dieting, which might get confused with some popular dieting methods at the moment, intermittent fasting. Now, I don't know if you've actually conducted the research on it, but you've been following this in the literature for a period of time. So I wouldn't mind getting your views and findings on these strategies. So first of all, can you just sort of frame up what is intermittent fasting? What are some of the protocols?
Yep, okay. So intermittent fasting is a subtype of intermittent energy restriction. And intermittent fasting could be defined as when energy intake is very severely restricted to about, 0 or 20% of energy requirements for a short period of time, a short, sharp period of fasting or semi-fasting. And, usually 1, 2, 3, or 4 days per week. Some protocols involve alternate day fasting, so you fast or semi-fast on one day of the week and the next day you eat ad libitum, you eat to hunger, and then the following day you fast again, so alternate days. Some protocols recommend 2 days of fasting. That's like the 5-2 diet, where you choose any 2 days of the week. They can be consecutive or non-consecutive of fast, semi-fasting, and then the rest of the time is spent eating ad libitum, so very normally. Interestingly, for thousands of years, there's been all sorts of religious fasts that involve this type of intermittent fasting as well. So, for example, sunnah fasting that a lot of people of the Muslim faith do involves having meal by mouth, sunrise to sunset, 2 days a week. So it's a bit like an ancient version of a 5-2 diet.
Mm.
So there's all sorts of variations on that, on those types of protocols. So what was your question? Sorry.
Oh, that was it. That was just a bit of an overview. So how do these compare, say, to just state caloric restriction? Is there advantages or disadvantages in terms of, you know, whether it's weight loss or metabolic control, hunger, and does it have any effect on this adaptive thermogenesis?
Yeah, okay. So when it comes to effects on weight loss or effects on glucose homeostasis or risk factors for cardiometabolic disease like blood lipids and things, intermittent fasting protocols and continuous energy restriction, they're equivalent. There's been several systematic reviews, some with meta-analyses. There's also now been 3 1-year randomized controlled trials that have compared the effects of intermittent fasting protocols with continuous energy restriction, and all the literature consistently says they are equivalent. So it's really a case of pick your diet. If you like the idea of intermittent fasting and it appeals to you, you can stick with it for a period of time in order to lose some weight, then go for it. If it's too hard, you know, that fasting concept, if that's too hard, you don't need to go for that. You can just use a conventional type of diet. So they're really equivalent. We looked into the literature looking at the effects of intermittent fasting on aspects of the adaptive response to energy restriction. And apart from effects on hunger, where there seems to be some hunger suppression with the intermittent fasting diet, we didn't see any other evidence of intermittent fasting regimes reducing adaptive responses to energy restriction. And this was true of, you know, there was no difference between diet types on energy expenditure, there was no difference on thyroid function, there was no difference on IGF-1 or IGF-1 binding protein concentrations in the circulation. We looked at a range of parameters from the literature. There wasn't a lot of literature out there, but all the studies that had compared these aspects of the adaptive response to energy restriction showed similar outcomes with both types of diets. So there does, however, seem to be some advantage of the intermittent fasting diets for hunger control. I mean, some studies say that people on intermittent fasting diets are hungrier and more irritable than people on continuous diets. And if you're someone who has that hunger and irritability on that kind of extreme fasting day, then it's not going to be a diet that's going to be fun for you. But some people do have this experience of reduced drive to eat, reduced hunger on those fasting days in the diet. And that reduction in hunger, paradoxically, seems to continue on the non-fasting days of the diet.
Right.
Yeah, so they've asked people, for example, they've told people, right, on every second day you eat 25% of your requirements, and then on the alternate days, you should eat 125% of your, no, 175% of your requirements.
Wow.
So it should balance out. But people can't eat that much on fasting days. They can't do it, or they won't do it, and they lose weight. So that's an advantage of the diet.
But overall, you're still inducing, say, over the week, a reasonable caloric restriction, which you could achieve if you just did a constant, milder caloric restriction.
Yeah, that's right. There seems to be ketosis that's induced by that fasting day, and we know that those ketones, they do get into the brain, and we know from animal studies that ketones can suppress those brain centers that are controlling hunger. So there's probably something related to the ketogenic nature of semi-fasting.
Interesting. Well, it's good to know there's different. It's perhaps up to the personal preference, because I think I heard you before. You might be like myself. I really struggle fasting. I'd get the hangry, but others I speak to, they find that it's really achievable for them. So I think it's what suits a person. Was there a rationale between that variance in response people have to fasting?
A reason for
proportion.
I mean, in the studies that have been done to date, they look at means and averages, and most research nowadays doesn't look at individual response.
Of course.
To we're still moving towards personalized research and nutrition, but who knows? People are different. Some people. You and me, we get hangry, and I can't cope with fasting. Well, I thought I can't cope with fasting, but other people, they seem to.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's tools in the toolbox for different people. Whilst we're here, there's another one that there seems to be some pretty good literature building on this one about the time restricted feeding, and particularly the early time restricted feeding. So, could you just explain the concept there and what some of the preliminary findings are?
Yeah, so time-restricted feeding involves, as the name suggests, restricting the time in which you allow yourself to eat. So, for example, you might eat only between midday and 6 p.m., so maybe you only eat in a six-hour window, and all the rest of the time you're fasting. And in terms of animal studies, there's really good evidence from animal studies on this, and also some emerging evidence on human studies. So the idea of it comes from the fact that we operate physiologically on a circadian clock, and at some times of the day our bodies are better at burning fuels, and at other times of the day our bodies are better at storing fuels. And if we eat at the right time, then our body will, if we eat at certain times, then we could potentially manipulate what our body does with the food, and ideally encourage our body to burn more food than store. With animals, when animals, rats and mice, are fed at the time, only at the times when they burn fuels, then it's been found that you can feed them as much rubbish as they want to eat, Tim Tams and, I shouldn't put any brands, but when we fed our rats, they really, really liked Tim Tams, rats and mice, they love those. But you feed them anything and they love those foods and they'll eat it. Even if you feed them a high-fat diet but if you only feed them in the times of the day when they burn fuel, then they will not get fat. Whereas if you allow other groups of animals to eat those foods ad libitum all times of the day or night, then they will get fat. So there's a good basis for the timing of food intake.
But the time-restricted rats are still eating the same amount of calories, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, there's the same amount of calories, which is really amazing. So it's some benefits without having to restrict, which is just that's what we all want. Although if we can do it with really healthy, nutritious foods, it's better than doing with only high-fat foods.
Yes.
So with humans, this has been trialed as well, and there has been a number of small scale at this stage randomized controlled trials where they've got people to eat in restricted windows, usually around 9 or 10 hours in the day, which doesn't sound very restricted, but you know, most people are eating for 14 hours of the day. We eat for most of the day. And that did result in small reductions in weight to the tune of 1 or 1.5 kilos over a period of a few weeks. So it did look promising. It seems with humans the effect may be related to the fact that you eat less. So if there's less opportunities for eating, then you do eat less. But hey, you know, if it's a tool that can help you to eat less, then that's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
With larger studies, they might find also some magic factor, like with the rodent studies, that you can lose more weight even on the same number of kilojoules, perhaps. But I think it's promising. So, I mean, personally, myself, I do try and stop eating after dinner. And, I, you know, it's something that can't hurt and it could reduce food intake and weight.
Absolutely, and it's something probably achievable for most patients if a practitioner prescribed just, you know, eat sensibly, but stop by 6 or 7 p.m. at night. Maybe don't start until later on in the morning. Let's watch this space. I'm really intrigued and excited about that research, and hopefully people don't misconstrue it and think it's an opportunity to have junk food concentrated in a small period of time, but hopefully common sense will prevail. All right, well, really uncovered a lot of stones here with fasting and the adaptive thermogenesis, so I'll wrap up shortly, but perhaps just could I ask you what current trials are you doing and what's underway? You've got some exciting things on the horizon?
Yes. So at the University of Sydney, we're always looking for participants for our clinical weight loss trials. So we're looking at variations of we're always looking for ways to help people to lose weight such that adaptive response to energy restriction is managed or reduced or acknowledged. You know, we're trying to tame that beast. The types of weight loss trials we're looking at involve severe energy restrictions, so using very low energy diets, which paradoxically seem to suppress some of the aspects of the adaptive response to energy restriction, at least during some phases of the diet. So this is something we're actively investigating. And we will have a new trial with that starting next year, 2019. We'll be looking for 288 participants. These people are people we're seeking within the Perth, say the Sydney metropolitan area. And so there's that. We're also running an Australia-wide clinical trial, which is done via online questionnaires. And this is looking at helping people to achieve weight loss while also helping people to address, manage, and reduce binge eating behavior. Because as we've discussed, dieting leads to this strong drive to eat, and that can potentially exacerbate that. It could potentially exacerbate binge eating in people prone to binge eating. And so we're investigating a trial called the Happy Fed, a new program, the Happy Fed program, that aims to simultaneously address excess weight as well as binge eating behavior. And that's an Australia-wide trial via online questionnaires. So I guess if anyone is interested, they could contact me on amanda.salas@sydney.edu.au, and I can put you in touch with people who could see if there's a clinical weight loss trial that may be suitable for you.
Great. Well, yeah, I'll put those links in the show notes. So, yeah, that's incredible. I'm sure many people are grateful you've made the transition from investigating mice to helping people. And it sounds like, you know, it's a real more progressive understanding of obesity. It's not, well, it is simply calories in, calories out on a basic level, but there's a lot of nuances there and how we can make weight loss successful for the long term. So I'm really looking forward to what you're about to publish, and also we'll remind our audience that you will be presenting at next year's International Congress on Natural Medicine as well for us. So yeah, we might have some further updates then, I hope.
Yes.
So
great.
Thank you for your sorry.
Thank you. Sorry. It was wonderful to talk with you, Nathan. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for your time. I think you're about to fly off abroad and lecture more. So I appreciate that at the short notice you've made the time to update our audience on these important and fascinating areas.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Metagenics Clinical Podcast. Find us on iTunes and leave a review. Join our practitioner-only Metagenics Facebook group to be informed of new podcast releases, keep up to date with key industry updates, and more. Visit metagenics.com.au to find useful links and resources relating to this podcast, and sign up for our e-newsletter.